Welcome back. I had forgotten to send out homework solutions on Friday. Realized that this morning and sent those all out. As I did that, remembered I had forgotten to check for homeworks 1 and 2. Has everybody received those emails? You have access to the solutions for those assignments. Homework 2 as of this morning, but homework 1 week from last Friday. No problems there. Okay. Good. Okay, then last time we went over overlap loss on both the turn off and turn on transitions, just a review of the turn on transition of the low side set with an assumed polarity of the inductor current such that we have full overlap loss based on some simplified model using the gate charge and the transfer characteristic of the device. We found that those losses can be modeled with an expression that looks like this. Overlap loss is 1/2 times the inductor current, DC voltage, times however fast we can turn it on, divided by the total switching period. In the turn-off case, we found if we have a slow gate driver, we get these losses again during the other transition. If we have a fast enough gate driver, we can reduce them down, not quite to zero, but we can reduce them down significantly such that as the device turns off, the voltage on the FET drain to source hasn't risen much above zero. The condition for that is that we really need our gate driver to be much faster than the voltage rise on the FET. That's this expression, gate current over gate to drain capacitance, much greater than whatever current is charging the CDS capacitance ratio of those. Okay. And that was the end of our discussion of overlap loss. And what I want to do today, I'm going to first kind of just give a higher level picture of what sorts of switching losses are going on in half bridge for a couple different conditions. And then we're going to look into modeling in a bit more detail these capacitive losses that we've discussed a little bit up till now, but look at some of the nonlinearities in those and how we can model that. Right? So general switching losses in a half bridge, and as we've been calling them, say M1 and M2 with just generic gate signals, G1, like this, and G2. Look like this for my low side. And then normal, I'll look at my switch node voltage versus time for a couple of cases. So first I'll look at what happens when the inductor current is in some certain polarity. Let's call this IL. I'll start with IL greater than zero. What happens with the switch node? And then what happens if IL is less than zero? When I say IL is greater than zero, I mean is really during the switching actions, it's positive, whether it's more or less constant, what the magnitude of it. We'll let that play out, how it plays out. Okay. So again, in steady state, we know G1's on. Label this VDC up here. We'll be up here at the switch node, down at zero, then back to VDC. And then when looking at switching losses, we're really concerned at what happens during the dead time around these actual switching actions. Okay. So in this first one, for IL greater than zero, what's going to happen? Initially, switch node voltage is up at VDC. I shut off the high side device. Immediately, the current is going to begin flowing through the body diode of the upper device based on the direction. Can't go anywhere else. Right? So what I'll see is, rise up a little bit by a forward voltage, ride through the entire dead time And then this is going to be a very lossy transition when I turn on G2. G2 turns on, it'll rip this voltage down. And in the process, it's going to have basically all of the loss mechanisms that we've talked about so far. During this transition, I'm going to see full overlap losses. I'm going to see full COSF losses. I'm going to have drain to source capacitor of device M2 charged up to VDC and shorted out. I have drain to source capacitance of the high side device at 0 volts. I'm going to forcibly charge it to VDC through this resistance. I'm going to have the overlap losses because I am turning this device on in a clamped inductive load type situation. The high side body diode is clamping the voltage. I've got a fixed current. I'm going to have full overlap losses. Additionally, prior to that, during this whole dead time, I will have diode conduction type losses. I haven't explicitly shown any models for that, but if I've got a long dead time and I've got the current going through a body diode for that entire period, I'll have ILVF times T dead time type total energy. I'll do that once per period, so it'll be multiplied by FS for power losses. A conduction loss, essentially, but it'll show more like a switching loss. It'll be proportional to switching frequency because it happens for a fixed amount of time each period. Okay. This here is more or less a zero loss transition. So I'm able to turn off M1 with no problem. It turns off the current forward bias at the body diode, essentially turning back on the ideal switch here. This thing is still conducting, but I'm able to turn off the set channel part of it without any losses. There's no voltage across it as I'm turning off. There's no significant change in capacitor voltage. So this is about a zero loss turn off. About zero loss. The only other mechanism I'll mention on this transition is here, in addition to overlap and COSS, if I am conducting up through the body diode of this high side device, and that's a PN type minority carrier body diode, then as I turn on this device, I actually have the reverse recovery of that body diode loss. I might have reverse recovery. So that's the kind of switching transition we'd really like to avoid right here. We've got overlaps, USS, reverse recovery, everything happening all at once. Additionally, very fast DVDT and potentially EMI problems because of that. Okay, so now let's look at this second dead time. Given the inductor polarity, what's going to happen? I've been conducting through M2. The switch node's down at zero. I shut off M2. Inductor current polarity is such that can't go through the high side body diode because V switch is still at zero. Wrong polarity to go through the low side body diode. So that current is going to split between the two CDS capacitances. These capacitances have the same value. IL will split evenly through both of them, charging V switch and discharging this high side voltage, which is VDC minus V switch. Negatives will cancel out, so both are bringing V switch up. So what I'll see is a transition where this begins to go up after I turn off. And the slope of that and where it makes it to depend on current capacitance, time, the exact details of this transition. As we've drawn before, I could be something nice like this. It could be something like this. could be something like this. Depending on those exact details. So what sort of losses am I going to have here? With this transition, what I'm going to end up with is my partial overlap losses. Here, how much I get really depends on how true this inequality is. IG over CGD is really much, much bigger than IL over CDS. I should get very little loss. If not, I could get up to full overlap type losses here. This is my partial overlap. Not going through any body diode in this, so I don't have, well, at this moment, not conducting through any body diode, so I don't have to worry about reverse recovery. COSS losses, right here at this transition, I'm just charging a capacitor with an inductor, so I don't have to worry about the COSS losses till I get to the end of the interval. And then where I make it during this dead time will dictate whether or not I have COSS losses. So in this one here, I'll have some partial COSS loss. And the other two that I've drawn, I won't have any COSS loss because I've transitioned the voltage through resonance with the inductor all the way to VDC before I turn the device on. This one, I didn't quite make it there. So this remaining voltage will get shorted out as I turn on G1. I also have the potential for some body diode conduction up here. My voltage transition is faster than the dead time. But when I eventually do turn on G1, I still won't have any reverse recovery, even if that diode is conducting. Because I'm not, as was the case here, having a diode conducting, ripping all the charges out to turn on the other device. Instead, I'm having the high side diode conducting and just turning on that device, which will transition the conduction pathway from body diode path over to the channel. But it doesn't put some large voltage across it and rip those charges out through a high potential. Okay. Questions on that? Yeah, there could still be a little bit of loss there. In general, that should be much less than any of the mechanisms that we've talked about, even partial COSS. But you do still need to get those minority carriers out so that you can conduct through the majority carrier pathway. But they're not moved, like I said, not removed through VDC. They're recombining within a VF. It's got multiple pathways. There may be some minor loss mechanisms associated with that process. It can be relatively insignificant. It's a great question. That's what the rest of the lecture today is about. So let me hold off. Ask again at the end of class if I haven't covered it, but we'll go into detail on that. Yeah. Opposite. What do you mean? Oh, yeah. I just grabbed a half bridge. But you're right. For how I'm talking about them, these should be on MOS devices. Good catch. My mistake. Okay. So in this bottom plot, what happens if we reverse the current direction? Well, the nature of these two transitions is just going to flip, right? The current's going the other way. During my conduction intervals, I'll have the same voltages. But now this first transition is going to be the one where I have the potential to get zero voltage switching, the potential for low loss. My second transition is going to be the one with all of the overlap, full COSF losses. If the current's less than zero, here's where I'll conduct through a body diode and then have full loss. This one, depending on how it's designed, could be really nice or could have some partial loss mechanisms. Really just the opposite case. Before we move into COSF losses, I just want to kind of talk about, ideally, what would we achieve? So what switching transitions do we like? So this here is a pretty nice turnoff where I can turn off the device and really have almost nothing happen, no loss mechanisms, just keep the voltage there. Okay. This here is close. I'm trying to specifically highlight this bottom one because I still have some overlap losses. And given that I will have partial overlap losses, I like it if the drain to source voltage doesn't rise very quickly. So I can shut off and the gate can get all the way to zero before the drain to source voltage rises much. Same thing here. The switching loss perspective, I like IL over CDS to be small because that's going to make the DVDT small when I shut off, get the gate all the way to zero before the voltage rises. But then at the turn on, I kind of like this one here, which comes up. I have no COSF losses, but also no body diode conduction. It gets right to VDC as I turn on this device. Those are kind of my minimum loss characteristics. So just conceptually, let me think about for some example, MOSFET, what might I like, ideally, the switching waveforms to look like? So as I get the VGS and my VDS on some MOSFET, turn it on, turn it off. What would be my great low switching loss waveforms for this thing? Well, really like during any of my switching time to have the degree of the switching action already completed. I'd like it if before I turn on the thing, the voltage has already gone down to zero. And then as I turn it off, the voltage doesn't rise too quickly, otherwise I'll get some turn off overlap losses. Ideally, I would find a way to get my VDS to look something like this, where it's coming in with a low slope, kind of insensitive to timing, and then after I turn off, got a really low slope, but then somehow gets up here. Okay. I'd like to have DVDS, DT, about zero as I shut off. For reasons we talked about here, this all comes from this condition, comes from my DVDT. That's about zero. It means as I'm shutting off, VDS isn't changing at all. I get low turn off losses. And then from the perspective of turn on, I'd like the voltage to have already gone to zero before I turn it on. So basically, switched before I even switch it. Now, what it does during conduction, I haven't drawn a half bridge here, I'm just talking about a single MOSFET. And for it to work in just about any of the PWM converters that we've talked about, it's going to have to block some voltage, get any useful conversion ratio out of it. I'd like it to get up there quickly and go to whatever voltage I need it to. So this is in any of the simple PWM topologies. I've got the buck converter with an output voltage of 1 volt. This device needs to apply a total volt seconds of 1 volt times TS to the left side of the inductor. So I have some constraint on the average voltage here. Right? Just conceptually, my volt second balance is going to require that my switches have some total voltage applied to them. Okay. I can get nice waveforms like these using resonance. We looked at this in the beginning example. But the price I pay, I make it a fully resonant converter, as I have higher peak stresses. But I can get something that has really nice behavior at these switching transitions at the cost of some additional overvoltage. You get waveforms that look a little bit more like this from something like a DCM converter. Problem is, the DCM converter, we looked at previously, a DCM boost. I've got one kind of high current transition where these slopes will be pretty steep. The other one can be relatively shallow, but I can't keep this low turn off loss everywhere. Can't get it truly to zero loss. One of those will have some steep rise. More of the FYI than anything else at this point, but when you go to the very high frequency converters, 100 megahertz research above that's being done now, what they'll look at is waveforms like this. And then to try to mitigate some of this peak over voltage, they'll sometimes do some harmonic injection, where you've got a resonant circuit to generate this waveform. You'll add some third harmonic that can give you a waveform that looks like this. You can get the peak stresses down a little bit. Wasn't drawn as well. Reduce your peak stresses a little bit, but keep these really low loss waveforms where I not only have zero voltage switching, but also have low DVDT at turn off to limit those overlap losses if I shut off the device. Okay. Informational. Okay. So we have these different loss mechanisms, kind of covered overlap loss. In truth, when you start to have many of these mechanisms at the same time, for example, this transition where I'm having overlap, COSS, and reverse recovery all at once, the waveforms that we sketched for overlap loss, some of the calculations, will deviate because we've looked at a single mechanism at a time. So we solved overlap loss assuming no COSS, reverse recovery, assuming none of the rest of this is going on. When you throw all of them in there together, along with parasitic inductances, and other nonlinearities, the waveforms won't follow what we did for any of these individual loss mechanisms. More often than not, though, your goal is to gain insight into these things and figure out how to reduce them rather than have an exact calculation of what's going on here. You're not going to do anything about it. You're not going to design to reduce them. Why do you care to calculate them? They are what they are. Okay. If you need extremely accurate numbers for switching loss under a given condition, particularly for these hard switching transitions, the best way is to measure those experimentally through something like a double pulse test. Use that data as an empirical model. Okay, with that in mind, we're going to move on to refining our model of COSS type losses to account for nonlinearity in these capacitances, which is a pretty significant nonlinearity. This comes from this plot that we showed earlier. When I'm talking about COSS losses, I'm really focusing on what's happening with the drain to source capacitance. For example, full CLSS loss. I'm turning on a device with full voltage on that CDS and dissipating all of the energy stored on that capacitance in the channel of the device. Okay. CDS is highly nonlinear in that the capacitance itself changes with voltage. And the reason is because it is this capacitance across the depletion region of the device. As I have MOSFET in cutoff, what I've got is channels off. I have this PN junction, hard to see in this plot, but this is my P plus body, my N minus drift region. This is my body diode, PN junction. As I apply a reverse voltage, this is in cutoff, that voltage is blocked through this expanding depletion region. It is region around the junction here that is completely devoid of free carriers. All the free carriers are removed, builds up enough potential to block this voltage. My CDS is a capacitance across that depletion region. So it looks more or less like a, neglecting some of the curving around the parallel plate capacitor. Plate up here, plate down here. But as I increase the voltage that this device is blocking, I need to expand that depletion region, uncover enough sound charge, be able to block it, and those plates are moving apart. As the voltage goes up, my capacitance's equivalent plates are moving apart, so the capacitance is going to drop as the voltage increases. Okay. So some examples are here. It's taken from different data sheets of a few devices. These blue devices are silicon MOSFETs. Green devices are GaN. And the red here is a silicon carbide MOSFET. You can see the drain to source voltage is very small. I've got a very narrow depletion region. I've got a parallel plate capacitance with very little distance between the plates. As I increase the voltage, those plates get further apart and the capacitance drops. Eventually, as I get to high enough voltage, it more or less levels out. But I can get, depending on the device, what it's made of and how it's designed, I can get a few orders of magnitude difference in the zero bias versus high voltage CLSS. That means for us, CLSS is highly nonlinear, where CLSS is some function VDS. So the first thing that's important to understand about that is then what is this CLSS actually describing? For linear capacitor, the capacitance gives us a couple of pieces of information. We can use it in equations like I is equal to CdV dt or Q is equal to CV. Which of those apply to this nonlinear capacitance? And to answer that, we talk about how this plot is actually generated. So this comes from a data sheet. The way manufacturers generate this plot is they'll put zero gate to source voltage and then put some bias drain to source, whatever value on the x-axis here, and then inject a small signal perturbation in voltage, usually at a megahertz, more or less independent of frequency, and measure the current response. Should be 90 degrees out of phase with some amplitude difference that tells you the capacitance. Right? So this is, in fact, a small signal type capacitance as measured. And you're putting a big bias and then saying put a minor perturbation at that bias, see what the capacitance looks like. If I have 200 volts drain to source and then add a volt of perturbation, what kind of capacitance do I see? Okay. So from measurement, it really comes from some small signal perturbation on current is equal to COSS evaluated at some voltage times VDS hat DT. This equation is going to hold if I take a capacitance at a given voltage bias. Any perturbation in current is related to the derivative of the perturbation in voltage by COSS at some DC bias voltage VDS. Capacitance. It means that COSS, if I take any single point on here, it'll tell me information about the behavior of the capacitance in the vicinity of that point for voltages, some epsilon to the left and right. It won't tell me anything about what happened back here. Okay? This value is what applies at 10 volts. This value is what applies at 175 volts. This value here has no information on the low voltage capacitance. With that, you have to take care in how you apply typical capacitor assumptions. For example, Q is equal to CV. I can say that around some voltage, my change in charge is equal to COSS evaluated at that voltage times some change in VDES. So if I'm at 100 volts and I add a nanocoulomb of charge, the capacitance here will tell me how much the voltage changes. But I cannot say that Q total, the total charge on this thing, is equal to COSS evaluated at VDS times VDS. This is not correct. Capacitance only tells me what's going on right here. The total charge depends on the entire curve and how I got to this voltage. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. You can kind of see if you look at these curves that they all have this trend where there are high capacitance at low voltage and then drop. The exact details of that curve vary from device to device. Some have this little knee in here where it drops very quickly. Suddenly all of them drop pretty quick here. Some of them have more of an exponential. Some only change a couple orders of magnitude. There's not a great analytical way to describe these curves, great curve fit that's going to be applicable across a wide range of devices. Sometimes there is an equation that's used, analytical curve fit used in example SPICE, like COSS approximately some base capacitance over 1 plus VDS over some base voltage to the M, where M could be a variable, oftentimes 1/2. Like a 1/√ type function. That will match kind of a standard vanilla MOSFET, okay. In fact, can be derived through some simplifications from just a PN junction, but particularly some of these more optimized devices, modern devices that have a lot of different advanced structures in them, this isn't going to fit very well. Okay. Mostly used for very simple devices. Okay, so given that a lot of the analysis we've talked about so far depends on this capacitance. And even more so with where we're going, we need methods to be able to deal with this non-linearity. Before I get into those, just showing examples from a data sheet we've looked at before, the COSS, CISS, CRSS plots. Those typically be in just about any MOSFET you pick, you find a data sheet for it. And as mentioned, generally measured at 1 megahertz, not for any particular reason that I'm aware of, other than megahertz is roundish number, easy place to measure. Lower frequency or signal analyzer might need a lot of current to be able to do this. You typically find that. No significant frequency deviation or non-linearities with respect to frequency within a limited range. If you get kind of a nice modern device, you might also get a plot that looks like this, which is EOSS, the total energy stored in COSS from zero to whatever voltage it goes to. So for a linear device, we know energy in a cap is 1/2 C V squared. You can see from this plot, we're not matching this trend. Instead, we have some energy that depends on this variable capacitance. But down here at low voltage, we see it rising very quickly because we've got a very large capacitance. When we get up to higher voltage, this gets a little bit more shallow, but gradually getting steeper because of this squared term. If this was, for example, fixed capacitance of roughly this value, the maximum capacitance, I would expect the energy to do this. If it was a fixed capacitance equal to this minimum capacitance, I would expect the energy to do something like this, maybe a little steeper. This should be more or less parallel here. Didn't quite get it. One last try. Closer, still not great. Should have this same kind of slope, but it'd be offset down lower. It'd just come in as a parabola. So the actual thing has this type of behavior. Okay. Let's get into how to actually work with this. And the way we're going to treat them in this class is using circuit-based equivalent capacitances. So rather than having to carry this nonlinearity throughout all of your analysis of the circuit, what we're going to do is we're going to develop methods to replace that nonlinear capacitor with a linear capacitor that'll give you a certain equivalent equal characteristic. Okay, I'll show how in a second. So to look at this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to equate how I would solve different characteristics for both a linear and nonlinear capacitor. And I can do this independent of the circuit that this capacitance is in, just looking at some generic capacitance, which is essentially nonlinear. The capacitance C, which is a function of the voltage applied to it, current through it IC, and voltage across it VC. As I mentioned, what I'm going to do is I'm going to first review just solving linear capacitance, and then I'm going to look at the difference in what I can do when I have a nonlinear capacitance. And I'm going to do that for charge and energy. When I talk about charge, the total charge in the capacitor, Q, is going to be equal to, well, for total charge, I can just integrate up all the current that's ever flown through it from time zero, where there is no voltage on it, has no charge up until whatever time. That'll tell me the total charge that I put in up to time t. So my charge I can write as the integral from time 0 to t of the capacitance, the current that went into the capacitance, dt. And the exact waveform of that current depends on the external circuit and what it's doing, but I can gain some insight by replacing this I sub c with the capacitance equation. I sub c is c dv dt. There, I just plug in for IC to equal to C dV dt, comparing that this is potentially a function of voltage. Simplify that out in a moment. I'm going to keep it in for comparison with the nonlinear in a moment. Okay. What can I do with this expression? You look closely at the solution for homework one. You've seen this, or perhaps you remember it from your old math classes. When I have something that looks like this, I can apply the chain rules for integrals. My dv dt dt, integral of a derivative, can apply the chain rule. What I'll do is get rid of time. I'll have to transfer my limits into limits in terms of voltage as I do so. So applying that chain rule, what I get is q is going to be equal to the integral of c of vc dvc. So now I'm integrating in terms of voltage instead of in terms of time. At the same time, I need to change my limits to limits in terms of voltage. So I'm going to go from 0 to some final voltage. In this case, let's just call it VDC. Okay, the voltage goes from 0 to my DC bus voltage, VDC. Call this anything, VF, some variable. Once the capacitance gets to that voltage, how much charge does it have? Okay, and then my last step, if this is a linear capacitance, then the capacitance is not actually a function of voltage. This is a constant. I can pull it out front of the integral, and then I'm evaluating the integral of 1 from 0 to VDC. That's VDC. So I'll get Q is equal to C VDC. Q is equal to CV. Surprise. For energy, it's going to be a very similar process. My energy is going to be the integral from 0 to time t of the current in the capacitor times the voltage on the capacitor. And I can, again, plug in. I is C dv dt. And again, apply my chain rule. Let's set my energy is going to be an integral in terms of vc. Same thing, only difference is now I have the product of capacitance and voltage instead of just integrating capacitance itself. Again, if it's linear, I can pull this capacitance out. I've got the integral of VC with respect to VC, and that's going to look like C times integral of VC is going to be VC squared over 2, evaluated from 0 to VDC, look like 1/2 C VDC squared. So these are my linear results. If the capacitance is nonlinear, where does that derivation fall apart? And it's really in both steps, both the charge and energy, right here. And I said, let me say C is linear. I don't care about the dependence on the variable that I'm integrating. It's a constant and I can pull it out. That applies only if this is a linear capacitance. If it's not, if there is some dependence on the voltage, I can't pull it out of this integral. I have to explicitly integrate it to solve this expression. So in the nonlinear case, what I'm going to have is I can't go any further than these green underlined expressions. Go from 0 to VDC. E is integral from 0 to VDC. And I cannot simplify further. Without either analytical expression for my capacitance as it varies with voltage. So if I wanted to constrain myself to something like this model, I could plug that in here for C of VC. Then I'd have something where I have terms of the capacitor voltage, some analytical expression, and I can evaluate that integral analytically and get some big equation answer. The other option, which is going to be more general, is to have a numerical curve for C of VC, numerical curve for how the capacitance varies with voltage, something like what I'll be able to get from the data sheet. And then I can evaluate these integrals numerically to know the energy and charge at any given voltage for that device. So, quickly here, let's say I do that. If I know this curve, I've got a numerical representation of this curve, and I can numerically take this integral and just take that curve, multiply by the voltage at every point, integrate up here, just take that curve and integrate it to a given voltage. That'll give me the charge and the energy stored in that nonlinear capacitor. For energy, if I actually take that integral, I'll get back this curve. Already been done for you if this is available in the data sheet. For charge, I'll get something not shown here. Like I said, the goal here is to reduce to something that we can use our existing circuit knowledge on. As at this point, pretty good at solving circuits, throwing some nonlinear element in there. Not so much, that's not something we've covered. So can we develop a linear capacitor that would have the same behavior as the nonlinear capacitance? The answer is, sure you can, but that equivalent linear capacitance is going to be very tightly defined in terms of how it's equivalent. Okay. So the linear capacitance can model exactly one thing, one behavior of the nonlinear C of VC. There is no way that I can take this full nonlinear curve, give it a single value, and say this is the same thing. I'd have lost a bunch of information about how it varies with different voltages. But I can say there is some single capacitance that would have the same energy in it at 400 volts as a nonlinear capacitor has at 400 volts. Can say there is some single value of capacitance that has the same charge at 200 volts as a nonlinear does at 200 volts. And if I know that's what I care about, then for that specific characteristic, linear capacitance will model things well. Okay. So for that purpose, we're going to talk about two different equivalent capacitances, the energy equivalent and the charge equivalent, which are basically the linear capacitance, which would have the same energy at a given voltage or the same charge at a given voltage. And the way to solve those is to just take these expressions that we solved earlier. So the charge in a linear capacitor is C times V. Charge in a nonlinear capacitor, this integral. If I set those equal to one another and solve for the linear capacitor, it'll tell me what value of capacitance would have this same charge at this voltage. So for charge, say they have the same charge. It is CVdC for a linear capacitor. And it is integral from 0 to VdC, C of VC, dVC for a nonlinear capacitor. So a capacitance of value 1 over VdC, integral from 0 to VdC, C of VC, dVC, is what we'll call the equivalent capacitor based on charge, the EQ, comma Q. Doing the same thing for energy. Energy is 1/2 CV squared. It's equal to integral from 0 VdC, C of VC, VC, dVC. So our equivalent capacitor based on energy, 2 over VdC squared, from 0 to VdC, C of VC, VC, dVC. In general, even if I say from 0 to some fixed voltage, 0 to 400 volts, these two capacitances are going to be different for a single MOSFET. So the capacitance which has the same charge as the nonlinear and the capacitance which has the same energy as the nonlinear are going to be two different values. I highlight model exactly one behavior. This one has the same charge at this voltage. Nothing else about it is the same as the nonlinear one. That one characteristic is. And it turns out from these two, we can solve things like total loss and hard switching configuration. They're going to be useful single things to model. Okay. Note here, is anything interesting about this expression? 1 over x times the integral from 0 to x. This is just the average value over that voltage range. CEQ, comma Q is just equal to the average value of the capacitance evaluated from 0 to VDC. This one is then some weighted average. I'm taking the average, multiplying by VC though, to weight, because the energy is proportional to the square of voltage, that average is going to be more weighted towards the higher voltage where more energy is contributed. And if the capacitance is smaller, voltage is weighted more heavily. Okay, I'm out of time. Next class, we are going to look at using these to solve nonlinear COSS losses in the switching of a half bridge. Thank you.